Before I begin, does anyone have any questions they want to ask? Okay. This lecture today, it's an overview lecture. I'm going to try and pull things together for you, focus on what it is that you would want to kind of take away from all the material that we've covered thus far in the course. And I want to stress the point that, you know, this is not a history course. This is a course that's ultimately concerned with these fundamental conceptual problems. What is there of a general nature that you could say about what makes for war? Right? Or is there anything? Is it just going to happen? Are there any insights you could draw from this about how foreign policy should be conducted? General insights, right? Those are the questions, the kind of questions that define the field of international relations. And we look at the history, not just because it's interesting in its own right, although it is. We look at the history for insight into those fundamental issues. Okay? And how do we proceed? Directly by approaching these issues at an abstract level, trying to thinking through for ourselves, you know, how the issue of war and peace should be dealt with. No, we have an indirect approach. We're reacting to what other people say. Okay? And we're reacting first and foremost to general views that people put forward about what makes for war, or just general ideas that people have about how war is to be understood. Right? Very common view that war is to be understood in essentially moral terms. It's a product of aggression. You want to understand what caused a particular war, you have to figure out who's to blame. Right? Once you figure out who the aggressor is, who's to blame, well, you've solved the whole issue of what caused the war. That's the fundamental view that we're reacting to. There are other views, like this whole notion of wars just kind of break out by accident. People stumble into them, not knowing what they're doing. Wars are brought on by the workings of the military system, which the political leadership, they don't understand. They can't take into account. They don't know what they're doing. Right? Also a very important view, but not as important as the whole notion that war is the product of aggression. And we're particularly interested in the set of ideas that arose in reaction to those notions, especially this notion that war is the product of aggression, that international politics is to be understood in moral terms. Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? You know, who are the aggressors? Who are the victims? Yeah. This is the view we call realism, which insists that international politics is to be understood in less moralistic terms, more political terms, where you don't make judgments, where you can understand the behavior of both sides in the system, because everyone is pretty much pushed to acting a certain way by virtue of the nature of the system in which they find themselves. The structure of the system based on power, a system in which there's no overarching authority, what people call an anarchic system. This forces people to behave in a way you might view as aggressive, whether in their hearts they're aggressors or not. They're forced to behave offensively for essentially defensive purposes, you know? Important set of ideas. The heart of the realist view is that power considerations, not moral considerations, power considerations are of fundamental importance. All right? And so we look at the history with that all that conceptual baggage in mind. A view that differs from the view that wars are caused by aggressors, that wars are to be understood as the climax of a process, you know, unfolding over time, unfolding not just years, sometimes over decades. Okay, a political process. And let me explain what I mean by the term political process. The term process implies, you know, it's not just things that just happen for no reason at all. There's a logic underlying the course of events. You know, one thing leads to another. People are reacting to what other people do, right? And if you want to sort out that logic, you have to focus on the whole factor of power, because the factor of power is like this thread that enables you to kind of make sense of that process. It's a political process in the sense of, you know, moral considerations are of relatively minor importance, very hard to make judgments about, you know, who's the aggressor, who's the victim, and so on. Okay? So we have all these notions in mind when we look at the history. And so we've gone through the whole story, starting out with the story of the origins of the First World War, covered in very broad brush terms. And what's the sense you get from looking at that story? First, in terms of the general origins of the war, very hard to say, you know, who the aggressor is. You know, it's like, can you blame the Serbs, the Southern Slavs, for wanting to have control over their own destiny, for wanting to kind of create a state that encompasses, you know, all the Southern Slavs, free them from the yoke of essentially foreign rule? Can you blame the Serbs, that is, for pursuing a revisionist policy and not simply accepting the status quo of a very small Serbian state? Well, can you blame the Russians for supporting the Serbs? Can you blame the French for supporting the Russians? On the other hand, can you blame Austria for wanting to preserve its territorial integrity, for being worried about the threat to its very existence posed by Serbian policies that's underwritten by these foreign powers, major foreign powers? Can you blame Germany for wanting to, you know, maintain Austria as a, you know, as a major power instead of allowing Austria to just go down the tubes? If, in fact, you could sympathize with the way people are looking at these things on all sides, then it's very hard to think of what happened in terms of aggression. Okay? And also there's the process element, the political element, the element that has to do with power considerations. It's like, well, what's the story? You have, you know, this gap opening up between Germany and the Western powers, you know, having to do with the two Moroccan crises, the 1905 crisis and 1911 crisis. You know, Germany and the Western countries are coming to view each other as their main enemy. And what is the political effect of that? The political effect is to empower Russia, to put Russia in the driver's seat. Russia had managed to maintain decent relations with Germany, as well as with the Western powers. And this meant that the Germans had some hope for improving their power position by weaning Russia away from her Entente partners and developing a much warmer political relationship with Russia. And the fact that Germany was courting Russia meant that the Western powers also had to court Russia. There's a competition for Russian favor. And the effect of this is to enable Russia to pursue a much tougher policy than she had been able to pursue when the situation was rather different. And so you have, following the second Moroccan crisis in 1911, a toughening of Russian policy in 1912 with the formation of the Balkan League. I should tell you that the French Prime Minister Poincaré, when he was shown the text of the Balkan League Treaty on a visit to St. Petersburg, he said, this carries within it the seeds of a war, not just against Turkey, but against Austria as well. Given that Austria was Germany's ally, Russia, in pursuing this policy in the Balkans, this forward policy in the Balkans, a policy of encouraging the Serbs to think in terms of greatly increased territory. Indeed, in the final analysis at Austria's expense, the Russians were playing with fire, given that, you know, Germany was Austria's ally. Okay? You could see the nature of the problem. Very hard to make moral judgments. Who's right, who's wrong in this? But there's a political process having to do with the estrangement between Germany and the West, leading to the empowerment of Russia, to the pursuit of a more forward policy by Russia in the Balkans, and this is what sets off this whole chain of events leading to the outbreak of the First World War. You know, it's like a different way of looking at things. You're not looking for who the aggressor is, right? And then we had a lecture on the immediate origins of the war, 1914, that focused on a theory. You know, the goal there was not to tell you in great detail of what happened at every particular day in the July crisis. It was to examine a theory, the theory that this was an inadvertent war, an accidental war, brought on by the workings of the military system. A very important theory because of the role it played during the Cold War. Well, in fact, during the interwar period as well, but, but during the Cold War especially, this inadvertent war theory, this theory that the First World War came about because of the workings of the military system, provided a historical basis for an important policy, the policy of focusing on arms control, the policy of trying to so alter the structure of the military system that no one had any incentive to go first. And why this great concern with affecting the structure of the nuclear relationship, a kind of a purely military thing? And the answer was, well, you had war that broke out for military reasons once before in 1914, major war. We don't want that to happen again, right? You know, in the nuclear age, obviously no one wants a nuclear war. If we should be afraid of nuclear war, it can't be because we're afraid that someone wants it. So a big fear has to be that it's going to just kind of happen by accident, that we're going to stumble into it, that these military forces are going to be unleashed, that no one can control, the political process is going to be overwhelmed, right? So the theory was important, and to kind of see whether the theory was valid, the historical interpretation was valid, that this is how the First World War is to be understood, we kind of looked at the arguments to that effect that were made, that tried to flesh out the idea that this was an accidental war, inadvertent war, right? And those arguments broke, you could break them down into three parts, you know, the rigidity of military plans, the cult of the offensive, the interacting mobilizations, look and see what people said about how each of these things supposedly led to the war, and examine those claims using two yardsticks. First yardstick was the logic of the argument. Like, for example, with the rigidity of military plans, that implies the war would have been avoided if the plans had been more flexible. And you say to yourself, well, why? If the plans had been more flexible, why would a war have been avoided? You know, it's like this visceral sense. Rigidity is bad, war is bad. There must be some causal connection between the two. Without people kind of thinking through, you know, why that should be the case. And also the second test is the test of evidence. You know, what's the evidence that's given to support the theory? There's the story of the August 1st misunderstanding when the Kaiser tried to prevent the war plans from being implemented and was supposedly he was told it couldn't be done. And it shows how they are locked into a set of plans that make no sense in political terms, that they're unchangeable. Right? Turns out that that story is totally false. It's exactly the opposite that was the case. You know, he's like, what's important here is that there's a method for getting at these issues. You always go from the big stuff down to the more concrete things. General arguments about, you know, why you have war, supported by a more specific argument about how war broke out in 1914, and that argument is supported by these various claims about the rigidity of military plans. Those claims about the rigidity of military plans are supported by the story of what happened, the August 1st misunderstanding story, when Kaiser tried to, you know, prevent the plans from being implemented. You analyze the evidence at the base, and automatically having set up the structure of the argument in that way, that finding that you reach about, no, that's not what happened at all. It was the Kaiser that prevailed and not the army leadership. Or automatically that has implications about the theory that the rigidity of military plans was an important cause of the war, that the war was, in a sense, an inadvertent war, that this shows how wars can come by accident. You know, you could see the power of this sort of method, right? That's kind of the point there. One of those three theories, three dynamics that were used to substantiate the argument that this was an inadvertent war, was the whole idea of the interacting mobilizations. And this is one of the things everyone should know. Is there a system of interacting mobilizations in 1914? Yes, there is. What is it? System is a Russian mobilization, general mobilization, leads to a German mobilization, and for Germany, mobilization means war. Mobilization means attacking France right away and thus bringing on the war. And everyone should know why it's the case that a Russian general mobilization would lead more or less inevitably to war. It's the logic of the Schlieffen Plan. What is that logic? Here's Germany, packed into the center of Europe, facing a coalition of these three great empires, British Empire, French, Russian Empire. You just look at the map, you know. It's like, well, one block is absolutely huge. How can Germany possibly hope to win? Well, she has this one trump card. She's very efficient. She could bring her forces to bear very quickly. Right? If she allows the war to become a war of attrition and gives her enemies the time to mobilize these vast resources, not just their own resources, but by virtue of the fact that they control the seas, also the resources of the United States, okay, Germany can't win. Germany can't settle for a war of attrition. I should just say in passing, and this shows you the power of a structural perspective, this is very similar to the situation in which Russia found itself in during the Cold War, when she faced a coalition of much wealthier powers, right? And what Israel faces, confronting a coalition of the Arab world, much larger in terms of population than Israel. You need a rapid decision in those cases. You can't opt for an attrition strategy, a purely defensive strategy, right? It's structural. Doesn't show you that any of these countries are inherently aggressive. It's built into the structure of things, right? And so Germany can mobilize faster, bring her forces to bear faster. You know, throw them into action faster than Russia. Russia mobilizes very slowly because Russia's huge, the infrastructure is not nearly as good. And this creates a tactical window of opportunity for Germany. She could leave her eastern border relatively undefended during this initial period at the start of the war when Russia is still mobilizing. Right? Concentrate the great bulk of her army in the west, and throw that army through Belgium into France, hoping to knock out France at the very beginning of the war before she would then have to pivot around and deal with a Russia that had completed her mobilization. Germany cannot afford to sit on her hands and allow the Russian mobilization to run its course, because if Germany did that, she would have to divide her forces between East and West. She would no longer have a sufficient mass of military power in the West to hope to knock out France. She would then be settling for a war of attrition, right? So the Russian mobilization would lead to a German mobilization and, in fact, to the German attack on France. Right? That's the logic of the situation. That explains why it was that a general Russian mobilization would lead to war. Does that mean that the interacting mobilization system was a cause of the war? It exists, but is it a cause of the war? Well, something has to trigger it, right? If everyone understands that this is the case, that if the Russians understand that mobilization is going to lead to war, and everyone understands the system, how could it be a cause of the war? Unless the Russians were kind of rushed into it by spurious arguments coming from the military. Right? It's like, are the Russian leaders free agents? If they're free agents and they make this decision to start the war for political reason, they order general mobilization knowing full well what its consequences would be, you can hardly say the system was a cause of the war. Any more than you would say that the crossing of borders, the attack on enemy's forces is a cause of the war. It's simply the first stage of the war. So you unpack the argument, see? And so you want to look and see whether, you know, the Russians knew what they were doing and whether they were kind of panicked into it, you know, whether they were free agents or not, right? And it turns out, yes, they knew what they were doing, And yes, they made the decision not because they were panicked into it, but they made it because they felt that war was inevitable for political reasons. That it was a question for them of whether they were going to abandon Serbia because Germany and Austria were intent on clipping Serbia's wings, and Russia committed herself to preventing that from happening. Right? Important point, because that's the heart of the inadvertent war argument. So you should know the logic of the situation there, why it was that a general mobilization on the part of Russia would lead to a European war. Okay? The war itself. What was striking about the war itself? Yes? Yeah, general mobilization means against Austria and Germany. Partial mobilization means just against Austria. Right? And partial mobilization would not have led to war with the same degree of certainty as general mobilization, because it wouldn't have forced Germany to act. As a matter of fact, the Russian partial mobilization would have messed up their ability to order a general mobilization, which was part of the reason why the partial mobilization order was rescinded. Okay. We have this theory that countries are essentially rational. They think in terms of their power political position, that their policies are to be understood in kind of rational political terms. Right? It's a powerful theory. And it helps you see a lot of things you wouldn't be able to see. But there's a danger in pushing it too far. And that's like one of the big lessons to be drawn from the story of the First World War itself. See, what's striking about that story? It's like, here's this military stalemate. If the realist view was correct, everyone would have seen it's a military stalemate and they would have agreed on a compromise peace. Policy should be in tune with your power position. The war revealed what your power position was. They should have worked for compromise peace. And yet, when you look at the policy of every country that was involved in the war, without regard to regime type, you find this extraordinary intensification of the commitment to the military effort, despite the fact that it was a military stalemate. You look at, you know, and again, the American policy is quite extraordinary in this context. It's not, oh, look at these German militarists, these ambitious war aims are the only way they could hold on to power and so on. They would be discredited if they sort of compromised peace. It's an artifact of the undemocratic nature of the German system. Not true. You look at the at the three Western democracies, especially at the United States. And here's Wilson, January 1917, before we enter the war, talking about peace without victory, peace of reconciliation, you know, compromise peace. By the end of 1917, we enter the war in April. By the end of 1917, the Germans got to be crushed. We have to totally destroy them. You know, it's quite extraordinary. It's like, in a sense, it's upsetting for people like me who tend to want to think that these issues are so important that it forces the top leadership to think in rational terms, to see how that was not the case. Yeah?
How does, in January of 1917, how does Wilson's advocacy for a settlement of equals overcome a German autocracy that's built on success in the war, if that's true, if Germany has sort of a fragile...
Well, I mean, you know, the assumption of peace without victory is that you could get the German leadership to see that total victory is not in the cards for them. And if they hope to maintain their position at all, they should agree to some sort of compromise. It's by no means obvious to Wilson in January 1917 that the Germans won't accept some sort of compromise. And the whole story of the First World War and the Peace Conference and the Wilson period, this gave rise to this critique, the critique that was developed by Kennan in that article that you read, a chapter from his book, American Diplomacy. You know, it's like, it's the Wilson policy, this kind of moralistic policy, a leader who is simply incapable of thinking in power political terms, in realist terms. This is what messed everything up. And it's like this suggestion, there's a problem here for democracies. He says, I sometimes think that democracies are like these prehistoric dinosaurs, you know, with a body as big as this room and a brain the size of a pea. You have to kind of whack them as hard as you can to get them to take any notice, and then they go crazy. He's like, wouldn't it have made more sense for the United States to exercise its power in a politically intelligent way from the start? You know, a very important kind of counter-argument, because it bears on this fundamental question that you should be asking yourself. Not that I'm going to ask you about it on the exam. You don't have to worry about this. But this is we look at this very striking historical observation, which is that the peace of 1919 was the only major peace in the history of great power politics to be dictated by the three great Western democracies and by them alone. You can't say that about 1815. You can't say that about 1945. Right? And yet it turned out to be the most unstable peace in the history of great power politics. Because, you know, like, it's in a shambles 10 years later. 20 years later, you have even this worse war with Germany breaking out, saying, is there a connection between those two things? Is it the case that democracies are just kind of incapable of pursuing an intelligent foreign policy? Right? You know, you recall how Kennan ended that article, which is basically saying, there's a problem here. Don't think it's going to go away. In the nuclear age, it's even more serious. So we better start thinking about this and better think in terms of what we can do about it. Right? That's the Kennan. A very important point. And to kind of get at that point, you want to look at the peace conference and the Versailles system, right? There's this whole notion, oh yeah, everyone knows Versailles peace, tremendous failure. And the fact that it failed, it had all kinds of effects, like discrediting the whole notion of American involvement in the war. If this is what happened, the last time we got involved in European affairs and what led to this peace that was just a disaster, why should we get involved again? Very important element in American thinking in the interwar period. Okay? The Versailles peace. What was the Versailles peace? What was the essence of it? right? Germany is inherently a stronger country than France, much stronger. You know, so what's to keep Germany from dominating Europe? Well, there has to be an adequate counterweight. Right? It's not by no means a sure thing that Britain and America are going to stay in. Right? The whole Wilson conception is not one of America is a European power, America has a permanent role to play in the European balance of power. He didn't like to think in those terms. Russia's out of the equation. Russia is in the throes of revolution and pushed back behind a wall of hostile East European states. What's going to keep Germany in line? If there's no adequate concentration of power that could keep Germany in line, and Germany is free to develop her power and then once again try to dominate all of Europe, then what was the point of fighting the war? Okay? So this whole notion is you need a set of constraints, artificial constraints on German power to keep Germany down, keep Germany from again dominating Europe, building up her power, dominating Europe. And the Versailles system is a set of those constraints. What are the most important constraints? The limits on German military force. 100,000 man army, very small for a country like Germany. A no air force, no navy to speak of. Germany being vulnerable in the West, Germany not being allowed to build defenses in the West, to militarize the whole Rhineland, this whole area between Germany and her Western neighbors, between the Rhine River and the French and Belgian borders, plus this whole strip on the right bank of the Rhine. Right? These are, you know, major constraints, artificial constraints on German power. Say, what's the justification for these constraints? Well, you're not giving Germany political equality. That's rationalized by the argument that the Germans cannot be granted equality because they had caused the war. Punishment is built into the Versailles system. Punitive element is built in there. Of course, it's, you know, people, they like punishment, they call it justice. This is not a peace of reconciliation. Wilson was not a great champion of a peace of reconciliation after the Americans came into the war. The Treaty of Versailles, very much in conformity with the basic Wilson philosophy. But then there was this whole big problem. Problem is, Germans aren't going to just accept something like this, especially since it's tied in with this judgment that they were a particularly evil country, that they were the ones who had caused this terrible war. Right? They're going to resist. Then what are you going to do if they resist? You're going to use force against them? Oh, no, you can't use military force in normal times. Only when the issues are so clear-cut, then you use it without limit. And you go to war, it's with you know, you're going to, you know, insist on total victory, basically. But in peacetime, you shouldn't use military force. Right? But that attitude on the part of Britain and France, knowing that Britain and the United States, knowing that France was ultimately dependent on the Western, Britain and America for her security, this is a source of empowerment for Germany and encouraged the Germans to resist the treaty. Right? So you have this conflict in the immediate post-World War One period, the post-Versailles period, the period from 1919 to 1923, focused on the reparation question, but it was not about economics or about money or anything like that. The reparation question was important because this was the easiest area for the Germans to resist the Versailles Treaty, and it was clear to everyone that it was the whole essence of the Versailles system, the system of artificial constraints on German power, a system of constraints that would keep Germany from once again dominating Europe. This was what's at stake. Whose power is going to dominate Europe? Right? And we saw how the conflict ran its course. Once again, can you blame the Germans for resisting Versailles? Or can you blame the French for trying to enforce it? And if you can't blame either side, then you can't view the post-war period in moral terms, good guys versus bad guys. You see it as much more of a, in tragic terms. Yeah. Okay. The climax of this conflict is, of course, the Ruhr Crisis of 1923. How is the Ruhr Crisis settled? Not with a French victory. The French basically have to promise they're not going to do anything like this ever again. And you think that that would be this enormous source of empowerment for the Germans, but it wasn't. The Germans can't really go headlong into a revolt against the Versailles system, throwing off the constraints, feeling free to kind of develop their power. Part of the reason is that they become addicted to the flow of British and especially American money to kind of sustain their new currency at its existing parity and to finance a rather generous, for the time, welfare state that was being constructed in Germany. Okay. Instead of revolting against the treaty in a very direct way, the Germans have a more subtle policy. This is the policy associated with the great statesman Germany in the second half of the 1920s, Gustav Stresemann. You should all know what the Stresemann policy was. Stresemann was a nationalist. He wanted to build up German power, throw off the Versailles constraints, and ultimately become the number one power in Europe. And when Germany became strong enough, she could talk in firmer language about the need for territorial changes, especially getting back the areas that had been lost to Poland, but also annexing Austria, perhaps even in the final analysis, getting back Alsace-Lorraine. But you didn't want to kind of be open about this. You wanted to kind of play a certain game. You wanted to play off the Western powers against the Soviet Union, balancing between them, telling each side that if they didn't give you what you wanted, you were going to lean more to the other side. Resist the treaty terms, rearm to the extent you can, even though it was in violation of the treaty, just pushing the limits, constantly pushing the limits in the expectation that eventually the Versailles constraints would waste away and Germany would be able to kind of recover her power, right? What does this mean? That the base people at the time, liberals at the time, thought with Stresemann and the policy of understanding, as it was called, the Locarno policy, the policy of reaching an understanding with the West, accepting the status quo with the West, the key treaty of Locarno, the Rhine Pact. Basically, Germany accepted the status quo in the West, including the demilitarized status of the Rhineland, as did the French, and this arrangement was guaranteed by Britain and Italy. It's like, well, they now have their security. Now they can give us what we want much more, right? And so it was a policy of pressure, right? It wasn't as though the fundamental political problem of German power had been resolved. The Germans were getting what they wanted because the Western powers, having made this investment, couldn't pull back from it. Right. I told you that wonderful quotation from Lord Salisbury about the communist era in politics is sticking to the carcasses of dead policies. And it rapidly became clear that the Locarno policy was not doing what British and French statesmen had hoped it would do, namely reconcile Germany and provide the basis for a stable peace between Germany and her former enemies in the West. And instead, it was the Germans were still nationalistic, in fact, more nationalistic than ever. But the concessions continue to be made. What are these concessions? Removal of Allied military control from Germany in 1927. Germany's freer to rearm. The evacuation well ahead of schedule of the Rhineland. The Allied occupation of the Rhineland ends in 1930. 1932, December of 1932. A month before Hitler comes to power in Germany, Germany is given equality of rights in matters of armament. She's allowed to arm up to whatever level she wants, just as the Allies are. Extraordinary. These changes are made even though the Western powers know that the Germans have not been reconciled. They see no choice but to proceed as they do. They know that a new threat is emerging. What is the proof of this? What's the proof that they understood that there was a continuing threat here? Well before Hitler came to power in Germany, well before the Depression even struck Europe. The proof is the French decision to construct the Maginot Line, this line of fortifications across northern France, from the Franco-German border, from Switzerland through to through Belgium. The decision was made to construct the Maginot Line in 1929, well before Hitler came to power, right? Because the French understood there was a continuing threat. The fundamental political problem had not been resolved, implying that there's greater continuity between the 20s and the 30s than we had been led to believe, that the story of the Second World War is not just the story of Hitler. There's a fundamental political problem that lies at the very heart of the structure of European politics from November 1918 on. Right? Is this to say, which supports a kind of realist understanding of how international politics works? Right? Is this to say that Hitler didn't make any difference? Of course not. Hitler made an enormous difference, both in terms of how far-reaching his goals were, as compared to Stresemann, but also in terms of his methods, the degree to which he was willing to run risks. Right? Although at the outset, Hitler was quite cautious. The Germans were afraid that his coming to power would provoke an ally to prevent a war against Germany. Right? They take great care in the initial years to proceed cautiously. But with the with the remilitarization of the Rhineland in 1936, the whole tenor of international politics shifts, and Germany becomes much more active in pushing the pace of things. Right? And you all know about the three great crises of the late 1930s. The Austrian crisis in early 1938, the Czech crisis in late 1938, and the Polish crisis in 1939. What is the main point to be taken away from the whole story of the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939? But contrary to what people have been led to believe, this was not a war that was deliberately engineered by Hitler. It was not a war that he wanted at that time. To be sure, he had come to view a war with the Western powers, hate-inspired adversaries, he called them, as inevitable, but he hoped to put it off to the 1943-45 period. In the meantime, he wanted to strengthen Germany's position in preparation for that shutdown. And that meant clearing the decks in the east. And he thought that the West wouldn't intervene. They hadn't opposed him when he was weak. Why should they oppose him when he's strong? Doesn't want a war. He doesn't want a great war. He wants late 38, he wants a little war against Czechoslovakia. The Allies cheat him out of that. He views Munich as a defeat. Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, views it as a victory. Hitler's missed the bus, he says. Okay? And the hope was that Hitler was just going to stop there with the gains that he had made, the German-speaking areas of Czechoslovakia. But he doesn't stop there. He moves ahead with Poland, and in large part in order to get territory with which to bribe the Poles into becoming a junior partner to Germany in Hitler's great crusade against Soviet Russia, he takes over the remnant of Czechoslovakia in March of 1939. German seizure of Prague, March of 1939. Why is this important? Because it's as though a great switch gets thrown, and the whole British policy of appeasement is discredited, because Hitler is now taking over non-German, non-ethnically German areas. And this suggests that, they're in no limits. You know, at some point he is going to have to be stopped, because Britain cannot survive as a free and independent country right next door to this German-dominated Europe. Right? And if war is inevitable, better to have it sooner rather than later. So the great switch in British opinion, you know, from appeasement to resistance, that takes place in March 1939 after the Germans had seized Prague, taken over the remnants of Czechoslovakia. Okay? So the British are, they don't want a war, but they're kind of determined to take a tough stand that could deter Germany. Germany is determined to take a tough stand that will deter Britain from coming to the aid of Poland. Right? Each side gets more and more deeply involved in this showdown, and neither side can ultimately withdraw without too great a loss of face. Hitler plays his last card on the eve of the war, the Nazi-Soviet Pact. The goal here is to deter the British, you know, to dissuade the British from entering into the war. They can't count on Soviet Russia anymore. The military situation is hopeless. Okay. War breaks out. End of story? No, not the end of the story by any means, because this is still a local war, you know, basically between Germany and Britain and France. By December 1941, it becomes a general war. You know, 4 days after Pearl Harbor, Hitler declares war on the United States. What is that political process, right, that led to the expansion of the war, the coming of the World War II as a genuine global war? Something that's to be understood solely in terms of Hitler's aggressiveness, Japanese aggressiveness. The West, you know, the United States is a country that asked only to be left alone, A.J.P. Taylor says. You know, true or false, right? Well, it's not true at all. The Americans are very concerned with what the structure of power in Eurasia is going to be. The Americans are very concerned with how it will affect our security if Germany is able to dominate Europe. We want the British and French to win. We become increasingly inclined to intervene. Roosevelt is held back somewhat in 1940 by domestic political considerations. And Hitler sees American intervention looming in the future. He feels he has to strengthen his position before the Americans intervene. The German attack on the Soviet Union in June of 41 has to be understood in that context. And it's the implications of that for the Americans that are the key to understanding American policy in the latter part of 1941. The oil embargo, the putting of the United States and Japan on a collision course, and everyone should understand why it was that the oil embargo put America and Japan on a collision course. Don't forget, part of what you're required to read is the chapter that I put on the course website about 1941. All of this stuff puts the story in a totally different light. Instead of, you know, American intervention in the war having to do with America being the victim of aggression, pure and simple, it has to do with a much more active American policy. When Germany declares war on the United States, it's not with the expectation that America's going to be defeated. It doesn't know what to do. Lost control of events, right? And in fact, with the German declaration of war in the United States right after Pearl Harbor, essentially the war is over. It's very clear, given what the resources are, that the democracies are going to win, the anti-German forces are going to win. And the December of 1941 marks the end of one story, but also the beginning of another story, the story of the post-war period. So let me end with that today. I'll see you in class for the exam on Friday, and don't forget to bring blue books.